This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
What's up, NBA fans? It's Danny Green here. For those who want an inside look at the league through the eyes of a 15-year veteran and three-time champion, subscribe to my podcast, Inside the Green Room. New episodes drop every week where we take you through the ins and outs of the association's top storylines, as well as breaking news and so much more. Be sure to subscribe to Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jesse Docherty covering college sports for the Washington Post. We used to have Jesse on the show all the time when he was on the Nats beat. The Nats were also worth being on the show then, Jesse, and hopefully one day they'll get back there. But in the meantime, you're doing good stuff and writing about really cool, interesting things. And really, as the college sports world changes, you've been all over it. So appreciate your time here on the show, man.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
So the story that you wrote that came out yesterday afternoon in the Post, I read it this morning, is about a group of women's basketball players that essentially want a seat at the table as all these new rules and regulations are potentially coming, as there's a huge settlement in play in college sports. They're like, we would like to have a word with how all that gets done. First of all, just to, for the background, like, what's the timing in play here in terms of this gigantic settlement that has happened and the push by any party who wants to have a say on what the world of college sports is going to look like moving forward?
Yeah, so the timing is April is a final approval hearing for the House settlement, which I think when you see it in a Google alert or you see it on Twitter, the big number is $2.6 billion, but that's just back damages. And I say just because what it's really going to do and how it's going to affect industry moving forward is that there's a second component of it where it's going to create a system where schools actually pay athletes directly for the first time ever. To this point, even with NIL, that has not been allowed under NCAA rules. So that's what this House settlement is promising to do should it get approved in April. And then if it is approved, July 1 is sort of the big date for the changing of this sort of system where from that point forward, schools would be permitted to pay athletes through NIL deals to have a really almost have payrolls really for their rosters in-house. So that's the massive sea change that is likely coming. And I guess the two key months there would be April and July.
So then you have this group of women's basketball players that you've reported on, specifically from the SEC and the Big Ten. How did this group come together, and what are some of the important details of what they are trying to do and also some steps that they have not taken, specifically unionization?
Yeah, so these players were organized with a group called the UCAA, which is a nonprofit players association, and as you noted there, and I'll get to this, specifically really not a union, and that's really important for this discussion. And I do know a lot of these sort of phrases and words can kind of make eyes glaze over, but they are really important sort of to the inner workings of all this. And what this group did was they formed in the last 6 months or so around sort of common issues like, oh, your coach also pushed you to play through injury, or you couldn't take this class because of your team's schedule, or they wouldn't allow you to do that major because when you transferred, your credits for this, you know, required course actually didn't really move from this school to the next one. So now you're out of luck and have to major in this. Like, they started to get on Zoom calls and said, well, a lot of these things that we're dealing with are really common. They're not just personal issues. They're really issues that kind of thread across teams and conferences and whatnot. So they get together, they form under this nonprofit players association. And I keep saying that because if this were a union or if the players had gone through, which would have been a much more protracted and longer and more complicated process of unionizing, then under federal labor law, there's a chance in some alternate universe that the SEC and the Big Ten would actually be legally obligated to sit down with these athletes and could face actual repercussions. As it is, there really is no legal reason for the Big Ten or SEC to recognize these groups, to bring them into the decision-making process, to kind of give them that seat at the table. I mean, you could say, of course, well, these are the athletes. They're the labor. They should get that seat. But it's just a much, it's kind of frankly easier, or there's more of a tried path to that when you are a union. So the sort of players association element of it makes it a bit muddy, but essentially these players sent letters to those commissioners. They got 120 signatures across the letters and all, which is a lot of names. And they said, will you meet with us to explore what a partnership could look like so we could have a voice in plotting the future of college sports and these next steps? And the commissioners just frankly said no.
Jesse Dougherty, Washington Post, with us, wrote a great story in the Post. You can read it at WashingtonPost.com/sports about this group of women's basketball players at the college level who are trying to get a seat at the table as the NIL world gets shaping over the next couple of months. As Jesse mentioned just a few minutes ago, there's a House settlement that is currently pushing them on a certain timeline. So it's kind of now or never. So Jesse, with that, who is making the decisions here? Like, who is at the table if the players are not?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So this House settlement is really being hashed out between the plaintiff's attorneys for the athletes in this case, and then the six plaintiffs. And that's the Power Five conferences. I know the Pac-12 is no longer a power conference, but at the time of the lawsuit, it was. And then the NCAA. So the lawyers for those groups, the athletes, and then on the other side, the power conferences and the NCAA are the ones who have really hashed out, this whole settlement. Now, there are working groups within the NCAA. They're in theory talking to other commissioners and ADs and whatnot about how they want this to look and all that. But really, it's a pretty small group that's sort of deciding and negotiating and bargaining over some really, really critical rule changes that would exist then for 10 years. That's the life of the settlement. And while, of course, there's probably room within that to have some changes as sort of the markets evolve, as sports change, et cetera, like the structure that they're talking about that would come about if the settlement is approved is a decade-long structure. So the sort of skeleton of it would be in place for that long. And that's why these are pretty critical discussions. And yeah, that's at the table as of now. So as far as athlete representation, what sort of the devil's advocate argument would be is that the athletes are all part of this massive antitrust class that is represented by Steve Berman and Jeffrey Kessler, these very, very sort of prominent, very successful plaintiff's attorneys, and that's their seat at the table. And there are sort of meetings with those attorneys, with the athletes, yada, yada. But yeah, there's not actually any direct athlete sitting down or saying, we have a union or representative body or a players association or whatever it may be that is sort of going to represent us specifically. It's through the lawyers on the plaintiff side.
Kessler specifically is like a titan of this field. Not only his work against the NCAA, but I believe he was also the U.S. Women's National Team Players Association attorney in their settlement with U.S. Soccer a couple years ago, their equal pay lawsuit. So what is it that this group of athletes want that Kessler and the attorneys that are representing the athletes, like what specifically are their complaints? Is it about just like, hey, we want to be able to speak for ourselves and have the seat, or are the things that they don't see or foresee happening in the actual nuts and bolts of the negotiations that they feel like they need to step up and represent themselves to get?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think like the actual, like, here's our 10 asks or here's our 5 asks is probably not even really hashed out. I think the one thing I will say is like the settlement does not cover everything. So like it brings about a mechanism for revenue sharing between schools and athletes. It has rules on roster limits that have been very controversial. It has rules on scholarships that would change things. But, like, it doesn't necessarily address, like, some health and safety concerns or some academic protections or, like, whatever it may be. So, like, while I think the women's athlete earning power and the sort of divide between male and female athletes earning power, even in the context of the House settlement, was on the list of issues that this group of women's basketball players brought forth and sent to the conferences and talked to me about, I think there's a lot also outside of the context of the settlement that really would be of interest as well. So like, it's not necessarily like we don't feel as if Jeff Kessler and Steve Berman and the plaintiff's lawyers are representing us well, although, I mean, I'm sure if you ask specific athletes, they might have, you know, more nuanced opinions. Like, I think it's just like there's a lot of change going on that could affect a lot of athletes in a lot of different ways. And like, for them to not have specific representation as that's unfolding is the problem. And like, you know, you ask 10 people in college sports, you'll get 10 different opinions on whether the athlete should be sitting there or in what sense or in what, you know, in what capacity, all those things. But like that, I think that is more the argument. There's a lot that falls outside of the settlement that has to get hashed out too.
Jesse Dougherty, Washington Post, with us here on the Hoffman Show. Obviously, the history of women's athletes being, or female athletes being undervalued and women's sports being undervalued, long, painful, terrible in all the ways. And that is a part of this. There's a great quote at the very end of your story about this. But there's also just the reality in college sports in general that when it comes to revenue, there is football and there is everything else. How is this settlement and some of the issues at play here, how much of it is about the fact that football is such a gigantic thing that I think a lot of people would say should just like literally be its own thing, different set of rules for football versus everyone else, versus the continued undervaluing of women's sports that we've seen from the NCAA and others for decades?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think if you believe that this settlement is doing right by athletes, at least in some ways, I think it's hard to ignore the fact that it is so lucrative in the back damage portion with that, you know, over $2 billion. And the fact is the NCAA really only settled because they were afraid of the damages being even higher. Those big numbers only exist because of the value of football and because of the value of football contracts and because of athletes' inability in the past to share in the value of those football contracts. Like, that's how these numbers get bigger and bigger and bigger. And like, if this was a antitrust case about sort of NIL payments not paid out to men's soccer players, I'll stay in men's sports, like it wouldn't be so big financially. And conversely, it also probably wouldn't have the ability to create something like a new revenue sharing system. So, you know, there are a lot of people who would say, well, that's fine. I mean, the free market's working as it should with the NIL market, and that's okay. And there are others who say, you know, schools should be able to pay athletes and frankly should be, you know, forced to, not just permitted. And that only is happening because of the prominence of football in our culture and how much of a moneymaker it is. Now, that does not mean that female athletes should be exploited for their labor on the other side. But I think the sort of key context here is that sort of there's so much money at stake, and the sort of potential for even more money being at stake is what's brought about sort of bigger systemic change as part of this settlement. Now, those are all sort of thorny arguments, because some people who maybe have been pushing for that systemic change for decades are some of the people who are also objecting to a lot of the terms of the House settlement. They don't like how it fixes prices on with a salary cap. They don't like how it could take opportunities away from future female or walk-on male athletes. That, you know, there are things with it that even the most staunch, you know, pro-athlete sort of advocates have really big issues with. So it's not all great for everyone. It's going to be really hard to get everyone to agree on anything, especially in a college sports landscape where, you know, I'm going to pick random schools, but like Alabama and Furman are under the same umbrella of rules at Division I. Like, it's never going to really make a ton of sense when that's the sort of start of the conversation. But you're right to point out that while there is exploitation of female athletes in this case and then male athletes as well, like sort of the overarching theme of this is that like this is such a big business because of college football to begin with, and then from there sort of everything trickles down. So that's sort of really, really key context, I think, for all this.
Last couple of things here for Jesse Dougherty of the Washington Post. First of all, Jesse, of all the random schools you could have picked, the fact that you picked Furman, a school that I grew up 30 minutes from and my dad in his retirement is currently taking classes at for funsies, that's a hell of a pull by you. How did you land on Furman?
I just was thinking big school, small school. That's it.
That's incredible. Funny. That is unbelievable. Excellent work out of you. And then the last actual thing here is obviously they want to, this collective wants representation at the table for this settlement. But as you said, this is all going to get hashed out over the next couple of months with that big July 1st date looming. And then there is the next 10 years and what happens to college sports. And with that, the shifting dynamics and the growing popularity of women's basketball specifically becomes even more under the microscope. As I tend to think, this is a personal opinion from a sports talk host who gives opinions all day, but like, I think the men's and women's games are just going to go back and forth over the next 10 years based off where the stars are. If it's Juju versus Paige in the national championship game this year, there's a great chance that that game outrates the men's game. If it's Cooper Flagg versus someone else, maybe it's the men's game, but like, they are now much more on equal footing. And so what is the plan here going forward? And the, obviously, the other part of this is college athletes. The athletes are always churning. It's hard to unionize. It's hard to establish any continuity because the athletes are, by nature of being college students, always churning. So how is this group thinking about beyond this settlement to the extent that they are thinking beyond this settlement?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the immediate plan is for more public pressure to try to get those meetings they initially sought out with these key college commissioners. And I think an important thing to note is that if you want a seat in NCAA decision-making or college sports decision-making, like, the best place you can go right now is the SEC and Big Ten. Like, they are driving the bus. They're meeting today in New Orleans where they're talking about college football playoff expansion. And that's a whole other radio hit, maybe 10 radio hits to unpack why they're that powerful. But like, that is, as far as strategies go for who to talk to, that those are, that's pretty good. So when I did ask these female women's basketball players, like, what's next? Same thing you're asking me. Like, they seem pretty intent on trying to get that meeting, trying to talk to these folks. And in order to do that, I think the plan is to sort of apply public pressure, maybe start telling some of these stories and these, and illuminating these issues more publicly. I'm not positive what the tactics are going to be, but it might be similar to how you see sort of unions try to get their management's company attention when they're in bargaining or trying to get a fair contract. So that's sort of immediate. And I think the point you make about the longer term outlook is really, really important in that, like, I don't know what the long term plan is, because these athletes who I talked to were largely juniors and seniors and grad students. And like you said, in a year or two, they'll now be either playing professionally or in the professional workforce doing something else. And like, and it's hard to know, like, if the next group will be indoctrinated into that, like as a labor organizer, that's what you hope for. And that's sort of a big part of it, is sort of the next generation being adopted into the cause. But, you know, like you said, like, a lot of iterations of college athletes have sort of tried this, whether it's unionization or players associations. And it's obviously more prominent than ever, given that the athletes are finally getting paid, but it's not easy. And like, there's, you know, professional sports unions are, you know, strong in some cases when they have really, really strong and prominent veterans, but that still takes sort of some rookies and talented players and young quarterbacks or shortstops or whatever it may be to be involved too. So like, the strongest union has both, you know, Max Scherzer, I'll use a baseball example, and Trey Turner, you know, and that's because I knew for, you know, working, you know, on the Nationals beat for a long time that those two guys were very union involved and they were on very specific ends of their career. So that's hard to mimic in college sports. Even a freshman and senior is still pretty close together in age, and the lifespan of those players in the industry is not so long. So it is a really difficult challenge, I think, to continue that organizing, but that's we'll see if it can be done.
Yeah, for sure. The power dynamics there, the fact that you're dealing with the old ones being 22 and the new ones being 18, there's just a lot of stuff that goes into it. All right, Jesse, we'll call you tomorrow about the college football playoff. I'm kidding. I'm not working tomorrow. Someone else might call you. Jesse, really appreciate the time, man. Good luck with everything you got going on, and thanks for all your reporting on this. This was great, and really appreciate your time talking about it here on the radio.
Yep, thanks a lot, Greg.
Yeah, that was awesome. Thanks, Jesse. Jesse Docherty with us here on the Hoffman Show. When we get back, we will have a very different conversation with Clinton Yates about the future of the NBA and really just kind of talking hoops, because the crux of the NBA's theoretical problems is the actual basketball. So we'll have that conversation with Clinton, who was talking about that a lot on his show this week, coming up next. We'll also take a look before the top of the hour. That's 6 o'clock, because apparently no one knows what top of the hour is. Long running inside joke on this show. We'll take a look at what's trending as well. This is the Hoffman Show on the Team 980 and always live on the free Odyssey app.